I understand there's a new sheriff in town. Who wants to kill him?
I do.
This is the Six Gun Justice Podcast with Wordslingers Paul Bishop and Richard Brosh.
Welcome to another exciting episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, where we celebrate the blazing six-gun action of the Western genre in books, movies, TV, and any other media. I'm Paul Bishop. Riding shotgun with me, as always, is my co-host Richard Prosh. How are you, friend?
Hey, I'm fantastic, Paul. Happy to be back behind the microphone.
Me too. It's been gratifying to see the number of downloads growing with each episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast. In fact, we hit a milestone last week with 10,000 plus downloads for the year.
That's really incredible. 10,000. We really want to thank everybody right now at the top of the show for your support and your enthusiastic comments. We appreciate each and every one of you.
We certainly do. We've had a lot of fun doing the podcast. It's really nice to know we're not sending it out into a void. We're glad there are folks listening who enjoy the Western genre as much as we do.
What Western trails are we leading our loyal listeners down today?
Rich, humor is a tricky thing, as you well know. There are those people who laughed at our antics in our last full-length episode on Western sidekicks, and there were a couple of sourpuss cowpokes who thought we were just plain silly. To each their own. But today we're going to take a closer look at how the West was fun and talk about humor in Westerns. First in books, then in movies, from the classics to the slapstick, and on to the disaster that occurs when what looks funny on the pages of a screenplay simply doesn't translate to funny on the big screen.
However, there are a couple of quick things we'd like to cover before we dive into our feature. First, we want to tell you about a brand new Western series from Wolfpack Publishing created by Paul and myself, The Legend of the Black Rose.
We are really excited about this new character who I've described since we first conceived of her as the love child of Zorro and Xena Warrior Princess.
The first two adventures of the Black Rose are both available as ebooks via Amazon, currently priced at 99 cents.
They are also available in affordable trade paperbacks with stunning cover art from acclaimed comic artist Daniel Omar Perez.
Look for them under our pseudonym A.W. Hart, H-A-R-T. For more information on the series, head over to Amazon on the link provided in the show notes or visit our website at www.sixgunjustice.com. You'll find links near the top of the sidebar for the books and for a YouTube video, Running with the Pack, in which we have a great discussion about all things Black Rose.
Rich, you told me about something the other day that I thought was really cool. How about sharing with our listeners a little bit about that cool recent experience when a passel of Western novels, books, and ephemera was passed on to you?
I visited a local antique dealer last week with no idea what I would find, and she asked me out of the blue if it was true that I was a Western writer. When I said that I was, she told me that her husband, a rabid collector in his own right, had purchased a collection of Western books and ephemera from a local Western fan who had corresponded with several writers 30 and 40 years ago, and would I like to see what she had to offer. Honestly, I assumed I'd find a few locally published small press books and some notes from people I'd never heard of, but to be polite, I said, of course, with as much enthusiasm as I could muster. I can't tell you how happy I was to be wrong. The pile of goodies included several autographed hardback books, letters of cheerful and some not so cheerful correspondence, old photograph postcards, and a few really unique items.
A true treasure trove.
It really was. Just to offer a few highlights, I was especially excited to get a big signed first edition of Carry the Wind by Terry C. Johnston. We've mentioned Terry before in connection with the Johnstone paperback books because his name sometimes gets mixed up on the shelf. Johnston is different from Johnstone. Different name, different guy. Carry the Wind is from 1982, and it falls into that category of epic Western saga that you mentioned, Paul, recently when talking about Gordon Sharif's book, The Untamed Breed.
Yes, you're right. The Untamed Breed was actually supposed to be Gordon Sharif's magnum opus. I read it. I really enjoyed it. It was really well done. But I have to admit, I liked his earlier, slimmer books better. The whole epic Western saga thing sometimes goes on a little long for me. But it was still really, really good.
The Johnston book, published by Jameson Books Frontier Library, is the story of a fur trapper heading into the Rockies in 1832. I also got signed copies of Elmer Kelton's The Man Who Rode Midnight, Alan W. Eckert's Wilderness Empire, Don Wright's The Woodsman, and a few others. Next, how about a newspaper tabloid insert packed with photos and printed in different colors of ink from 1918 promoting a spring program called the Miller Brothers 101 Ranch Real Wild West Show? This thing is in near mint condition and filled with outlandish sideshow style attractions and acts that we would associate with a Wild Wild West show. Roping acts, clowns with mules, real life Indian chiefs, a trick automobile, and I barely scratched the surface. It's just really a unique find. Finally, I was really honored to go through a pile of personal correspondence from various Western writers. These letters were written in response to fan letters that the local collector had written back in the pre-internet age. Some of the notes accompanied the books and some didn't. Most were friendly and informative. One was an angry response to a disgruntled series of comments the fans had fired off to the author about a book. I was able to return some of the letters to family members, including a missive by Don Coldsmith written on his official WWA stationery. Thanks to Wolfpack author Irene Bennett Brown for putting me in touch with the Coldsmith family. In response to my mail, Don's daughter relayed a great story to me about Don. He was big on personally responding to every single fan and person who took the time to write to him. And as with all of his manuscripts, his letters were handwritten. He carried a mechanical pencil in his pocket and wrote all of his manuscripts in a spiral notebook with that pencil, taking them to his assistant to type later. So whenever anybody would ask him what kind of word processor he used, he would pull that pencil out of his pocket and say, "Oh, just this old thing from Hansen and Kimmel Fertilizer." It did my heart good to return these pieces of family history. And I still have some letters from Terry Johnston and a couple from Dee Brown, if anybody out there knows the family of these men and would kindly put me in touch with them.
That's fantastic. You never know what you're going to find when you walk into a store like that, but it's not very often you walk out with this kind of a treasure.
For sure.
We'd also like to give you a quick reminder before our feature. If you are enjoying the podcast, please check out the links at the top of the Six Gun Justice podcast website, www.sixgunjustice.com, and consider making a one-time PayPal donation or pledging a small monthly stipend via our Patreon page to help defray our monthly recording and hosting fees and keep us moseying along.
I'm Sheriff Prosh, and I approve this message.
And now let's get out on the range and rope us some funny.
I think that clip is funny every time. Humorous Western novels are hit and miss when it comes to quality. But rather than dwell on the misses, let's look at those that we rate as worth reading. I'll start us off with the Breckenridge Elkins Yarns by Robert E. Howard. Featured in 26 humorous Western short stories, most of which originally appeared in the pages of Action Stories between 1934 and 1937, and the novel A Gent from Bear Creek.
A hillbilly mountain man with a coonskin cap, Breckenridge is a larger-than-life figure whose abilities to dish out and absorb punishment are part of the humor. Using his hillbilly dialect, Breckenridge narrates the tales in the first person, which carries the humor when his limited understanding of situations leads to confusion and complications.
His ill-fated attempts to help friends and relatives usually come to grief for himself and often those he was ostensibly aiding. His repeated romantic failures in wooing the eligible women he encounters are another recurring theme in the stories.
Robert E. Howard is much better known today as the creator of Conan the Barbarian and Solomon Kane. However, in his far too short lifetime, his Breckenridge Elkins stories formed the most commercially successful series of his writing career to that point.
Howard did, however, have trouble finding an American publisher for his novel A Gent from Bear Creek, which was really only a collection of his Breckenridge Elkins short stories connected together by additional narrative. It was eventually published in the United Kingdom by Herbert Jenkins in 1937, the year after Howard committed suicide, and copies of that rare first edition have sold for upwards of $8,000.
You never know what's going to be valuable, and the tragedy that was Howard committing suicide, we will never know what greatness would have come out of his typewriter had he lived longer.
You're so right.
Another popular pulp writer, W.C. Tuttle's longest-running series character, was Henry Harrison Conroy, the Sherlock of Sageland, who appeared in the pages of high-end pulps like Argosy and Adventure.
Henry is a stage actor and vaudevillian who has fallen on hard times, who is surprised to inherit a ranch near Tonto City, Arizona, from a long-lost uncle. And, of course, complications ensue.
They always do. The original setup leads to a series of calamitous events and a mystery involving Henry and his new friends, a drunken, washed-up lawyer named Judge Van Treese and Oscar Johnson, the horse wrangler on the ranch who has a fondness for prune whiskey. This trio of smarter-than-they-appear misfits, of course, prevails, but not before Henry, Judge, and Oscar spend a lot of time drunk, falling down, and getting into various kinds of trouble.
As silly as they could be, Tuttle's Henry stories were so popular because they were always well-structured mysteries. And when it comes time for powder-burning action scenes, Tuttle takes a backseat to nobody.
And taking a backseat to nobody, one of my favorite humorous westerns are the Wildcat O'Shea books written by Jack
Bickham
under his Jeff Clinton pseudonym.
Wildcat is one of my favorites, too. Bickham also wrote the book that was the basis for one of my son's favorite western comedies, The Apple Dumpling Gang.
And a far cry from the sweet Apple Dumpling Gang, Wildcat O'Shea is a fighting, whiskey-loving, deceptively good-natured galoot. With his saddle painted orange, wearing a blue hat, red shirt, black vest, tan Levi's, green boots, and fancy Mexican spurs, all topped by a shock of Irish red hair, Wildcat is quite the disarming sight.
Despite his appearance, Wildcat is as tough, smart, and determined as they come. Many of the books in the series start out with Wildcat in jail for public drunkenness and brawling. The sheriff then offers him a get-out-of-jail-free card if he promises to handle an investigation or a situation that the sheriff can't handle himself.
Whether it's to track down a missing deputy, solve a murder, stop a range war, or bring a dangerous owl hoot to justice, Wildcat always reasons he can handle the job with no problem. Just happy to be out from behind bars, Wildcat's irrepressible attitude is infectious as things go from bad to worse, causing his foes to treat him as nothing more than an irritating nuisance.
But Wildcat's goofy personality hides the rock-hard core of a granite-punching, fast-shooting, stubborn fighting man. And when he gets riled, the bullets in the fists are gonna fly.
And Rich, I think that's why I enjoy the humor in the Wildcat book so much. We laugh with Wildcat, not at him. We are in on the joke. We can laugh at his goofy clothes and his hazy persona because we know when the horseshoes hit the trail dust, Wildcat's going to come out swinging and turn his adversaries into the painful brunt of the joke.
I agree. In previous episodes, you talked about the H.H. Lomax books by Preston Lewis as humorous in that same way, where we laugh with the character and not at him.
Absolutely. In books like Bluster's Last Stand, Preston has created a sort of Flashman in the Wild West vibe, in which the character is always up to his neck in trouble and in funny when he comes up against some of the Wild West iconic personalities, from Billy the Kid to Custer, and he sets out to tweak them on the nose. Preston also wrote an absolutely hilarious standalone Western, The Fleecing of Fort Griffin.
Moving on from books to film, one of the earliest Western comedies we're talking about today is The Pale Face, which started out as a 1922 20-minute two-reeler Western comedy. Buster Keaton plays a butterfly collector who wanders into an Indian tribe who has vowed to kill the first white man they see. After being threatened with imminent death, Keaton saves himself by fashioning some asbestos underwear to survive a burning at the stake. The seeming miracle is appreciated by the tribe, and they adopt Keaton and name him Little Chief Paleface. Subsequently, he leads the tribe against a gang of outlaws and wins the hand of an Indian maiden. It's a short romp, but it's packed with some classic Keaton stunts, including a nail-biting scene on an extension bridge and a Wile E. Coyote cartoon moment when Keaton jumps off a cliff with nothing but a blanket.
Nothing but a blanket and a pair of asbestos underwear, I guess. 3 years later in 1925, Keaton returned to the West again in another silent film that truly needs no dialogue to be laugh-out-loud funny. In the aptly titled Go West, Keaton portrays a friendless, sad sack who drifts west to make his fortune. Once there, he tries his hand at bronco busting, cattle wrangling, and dairy farming, eventually forming a bond with a cow named Brown Eyes, which inevitably ends with him leading a herd of cattle through Los Angeles.
This 70-minute romp shows Keaton at his most frenetic as a character who is trying hard, but of course doing everything wrong. Stowing away on a train, which he thinks is going to New York, he soon finds it is, of course, going in the other direction.
And he makes good use of his props. When he falls asleep in an empty barrel, it's not long before the barrel falls over and rolls off the train. And that isn't the last fall he takes. What with horses and cows populating the West, coupled with Keaton's masterful ability to milk the most out of any situation, including, literally, milking a cow, or at least trying to. Keaton's comic genius cannot be denied, and Go West is the perfect vehicle for his physical style of deadpan humor, in which he should end up with a rancher's beautiful daughter, but chooses instead to end up with a cow.
Buster Keaton, along with Harold Lloyd and other silent film stars, brought comic westerns to the movie screen for the first time with shorts like The Pale Face and Go West, but Keaton's masterpiece was also a western, The General.
Inspired by a true-to-life event that occurred during the Civil War, the tale was adapted from the memoir The Great Locomotive Chase by William Pittenger, who was the recipient of the fifth ever Medal of Honor awarded to him on March 25, 1863, for his service during the chase.
The official citation reads, "One of the 19 of 22 men, including two civilians, who, by direction of General Mitchell, penetrated nearly 200 miles south into enemy territory and captured a railroad train at Big Shanty, Georgia, in an attempt to destroy the bridges and track between Chattanooga and Atlanta."
There's no doubt that Keaton makes the chase seem a lot more fun than Pittenger and his fellow troops actually had.
Yeah, no doubt, though Keaton didn't have the best time of it either. In the end, the General cost $750,000 to make, an unimaginable sum for a movie back in 1926, and a mediocre reception at the box office made it a flop for the young United Artists. Later, during the 50s and 60s, The General was reevaluated and has since been recognized as one of the greatest silent film comedies of all time.
By 1937, the comic duo of Laurel and Hardy had also moseyed their way out west, taking on a crooked saloon owner and his hussy of a saloon singer, who try to stop them delivering the deed to a gold mine to the young woman who is its rightful owner in Way Out West.
As with any classic Laurel and Hardy outing, the plot's fairly irrelevant, only there to provide a framework for them to show off their sweetly innocent brand of humor. With one set piece following another, it's inevitable one or two will go on a bit too long, and here it happens with the keep-away parlor chase and a break into the saloon escapade. However, so much of their comedy works so well, the bits that miss are more than forgivable.
It reminds me of my feelings about the Monty Python skits. 90% of it really didn't work, but the 10% that did work was comic genius. Now, I think that more percentage-wise works here, but it's the same thing. You have to sometimes put up with what doesn't work in order to enjoy the brilliance of what does work.
Absolutely.
In particular here, the several song and dance numbers are transcendent. In one instant, Laurel and Hardy pick up on the hiccuping beat of the musical Avalon Boys, fronted by Chill Wills, engaging in a dance duet in which Hardy mesmerizingly transforms from an ungainly fat man into a graceful, carefree spirit full of elegance and charm. It's absolutely sublime.
And they would go on to mine that kind of unexpected humor for many, many years. But let's go back to The Pale Face for a minute. The Pale Face title was resurrected in 1948 by director Norman MacLeod with a completely new storyline, starring Bob Hope portraying Painless Potter and Jane Russell as Calamity Jane. In The Pale Face, Hope sings the popular song Buttons and Bows, which won the Academy Award for Best Original Song that year. The Western adventure comedy was enormously successful and spawned The Son of Paleface in 1952, directed by Frank Tashlin, again starring Bob Hope and Jane Russell, joined this time on the screen by none other than Roy Rogers and Trigger.
In 1968, the movie was remade yet again, this time as a direct clone of the 1948 version, but with Don Knotts in the Bob Hope role. Knotts is perfect as a meek dentist who heads west and runs into Barbara Rhodes as Penelope Bad Penny Cushings, the Russell Calamity Jane role. I think the best thing that can be said about the Hope movies, however, is that they're entertaining, if not gut-bustingly funny.
Paul, humor is highly subjective, and our expectations do change through the years. What was funny in 1948 was far too subtle for 1968. And as we'll see, with an infamous Mel Brooks movie, what was funny in 1974 might seem downright offensive to some people today.
You're absolutely right, but before we get to the controversy that is Blazing Saddles, I'd like to talk first about a film that was roughly from the same era. I recently rewatched Support Your Local Sheriff for the first time in probably 10 years. It remains a delight, right down to the whole jail cell without bars shtick. James Garner is perfectly cast in what for him is an effortless role, which means it looks effortless, not that it is effortless. Garner's trademark light touch and the everyman fashion he brought to his seminal roles in Maverick and The Rockford Files has seldom, if ever, been duplicated.
With Garner, you just feel comfortable when he's on the screen. In this case, he uses his genial presence to carry the whole film practically on his own shoulders. However, that said, Bruce Dern and Walter Brennan certainly hold up their end in helping to make the fluff of the storyline hold together well.
And don't forget Jack Elam. He's also quite brilliant in the Festus role as Gardner's deputized town drunk. And when he breaks the fourth wall and talks to the audience at the end of the film, you can't help but like him. A guy who has played characters you love to hate so often that it's refreshing for him to play a guy you're unsure of who you come to love.
I'm not so sure the sort of sequel, Support Your Local Gunfighter, worked anywhere near as well as this first outing, though.
In my opinion, Support Your Local Gunfighter isn't necessarily a bad film, but having Garner come back as a completely different character was a foolish miscalculation. There was definitely room to successfully return the thinking man sheriff from the first movie, who was also fast on the draw when needed.
It was a missed opportunity. I too wish they would have brought back the same character for a second go-round.
Which brings us to another movie that should not have worked, but really does.
Despite the presence of Jane Fonda, I think Cat Ballou rises to the ranks of remarkable Western. And I'll let the comedic elements fall where they may because there's some darker stuff here to be sure. I really appreciated that part of the movie. In fact, the 1965 film starring Fonda and Lee Marvin was based on Roy Chandler's serious 1956 novel, The Ballad of Cat Ballou.
Fonda plays Catherine Cat Ballou, who only wants to come home to Wyoming and become a schoolteacher, but instead becomes the outlaw known as Cat Ballou. Lee Marvin is here in a unique double role as drunken gunfighter Kid Shellen and the kid's twin brother, the hired killer Tim Strawn. Marvin won an Academy Award for Best Actor for the dual role, and he definitely earns it with a great performance here.
The film completely mines the Old West, with the likes of Butch Cassidy showing up, and it references other classic films like Shane with some clever satire. Though, Paul, I'm no prude, but I have to admit it being somewhat shocked at one of the original movie posters I saw with a cartoon Cat Ballou bending over beside the Western legend, "It's that way out whopper of a funny Western, a shebang to end all shebangs."
You were shocked. Think about all the little old ladies back then. Talk about shocked. Although I bet there were a bunch of grandpas who secretly thought it was a pretty funny line.
It's notable to think about the original Cat Ballou cast that actually never happened, with Anne Margaret in the title role and Kirk Douglas playing the twin brothers. Both actors had a shot at the film, but Margaret, the producer's first choice and who later said she would have enjoyed doing it, lost out because of her agent. Douglas, on the other hand, allegedly turned down the role flat, but years later, he did play a similar role in The Man from Snowy River.
I always find it fascinating what the cast might have been, the first people that the producers approach who don't end up in the film, and then you get an entirely different feel to the film with the new actors that they bring in. It's an interesting process.
It really is, and in this case, Cat Ballou did go on to spawn two TV pilots.
The first one starring Leslie Ann Warren and Jack Elam, the other starring Joanne Harris and Forrest Tucker. Neither production was strong enough to carry Cat to the living rooms of America, but I'm surprised it hasn't have yet been reimagined.
And since we mentioned the small screen, let's go ahead and visit Fort Courage and one of TV's best-remembered Western comedies. F Troop was a half-hour television show on ABC that ran from 1965 until 1967. It had the unique distinction of presenting its first season in black and white and its second season in color. It's also unique in that I saw it described online as a sitcom Western, of which it most certainly has to be one of the very few.
And it's certainly a lot funnier than The Disaster, which was Tim Conway's attempt at a Western Texas Ranger sitcom, Rango, which we've talked about before as being universally reviled, despite my having a soft spot for Tim Conway.
F-Troop came out the same year as Cat Ballou, and I've got to think the success of that film maybe pushed ABC into giving the producers of F-Troop the green light. With a total of 65 half-hour-long episodes, the series tells the story of Fort Courage, a fictional stockade-style army outpost in the Wild West. The commanding officer, Captain Wilton Parmenter, is expertly portrayed by Ken Berry as the king of all clumsy bumblers. Every episode, Parmenter attempts some kind of mundane task, filing paperwork, walking across the room to lean against the hearth, something that always ends up with some sort of escalating slapstick routine.
Pratfalls and character-based comedy are the mainstays of F-Troop. In every episode, you'll inevitably see the wheel fall off the fort's cannon as it's fired. This results in the water tower crashing over. Every time. After more than two episodes, you might start to wonder why one of these morons doesn't just fix the cannon, or at least rebuild the water tower on the other side of the fort. But I still laughed every time.
If such considerations bothered viewers, and they did, the writers of F-Troop didn't care. They were having too much fun sending up the Western genre in ways it hadn't been sent up before. Most of the episodes rely on the shady scheming of non-com officers Sergeant Morgan O'Rourke, portrayed by Forrest Tucker, and Corporal Randolph Agarn, played by Larry Storch.
In cahoots with the local Indian tribe, the Hakawis, led by Chief Wild Eagle, Frank Dikova, O'Rourke and Agarn aren't engaged in serious crimes. They're just shady businessmen trying to make a buck off the army. It's all in good fun. And Melody Patterson as Captain Parmenter's sort of girlfriend, Wrangler Jane, adds to the show's 60s sex appeal.
I thought the name of the Indian tribe, the Hakawis, was funny. The legend of the tribe is that a group of Native Americans were walking along a cliff, fell off the cliff, were pummeled on the way down. They woke up, dazed and confused. And when somebody came along, they said, "Where the heck are we?" And it came across as, "We're the Hakawi." I always thought that was a clever story, but pretty politically incorrect today.
The way they treated Indians in general and Westerns, especially in comedies, was really pretty politically incorrect today. But I have to admit, "We're the Hakawis" still makes me laugh.
Paul, as a kid, I hated the handful of episodes I saw. I thought it was dumb beyond belief. And I would change the channel whenever I knew F-Troop was on. And despite a fairly extensive licensing effort with lunchboxes, books, and comics, apparently the rest of America was with me. I've since managed to make it through every episode of both seasons. Having an 8-year-old watch along with you helps, but it's never going to be one of my favorites. Before the show, you were telling me you've got a personal reason to relate to our next film.
In 1988, a buddy and I traded in our city duds for boots and cowboy hats, and went to spend a week in the saddle in Northern California, driving a herd of wild horses from their winter to summer feeding grounds. It was a wild time, something I'll always remember. So when City Slickers premiered in 1991 with Billy Crystal, Daniel Stern, and Jack Palance, I have to tell you, I was all in.
Billy Crystal plays Mitch Robbins, who along with his best friends Phil, Daniel Stern, and Ed, Bruno Kirby, are going through a collective early midlife crisis. Ed is always suggesting adventurous outings or activities that the three can participate in.
Running with the bulls in Pamplona, Spain, however, leaves Mitch with an embarrassing visit to the doctor, and is not particularly happy when Ed eagerly suggests their next adventure should be to go target parachute jumping. Eventually, Phil and Ed rope Mitch into another adventure when they give him a birthday gift of going on a 2-week vacation in the Wild West, driving cattle from New Mexico to Colorado. When they meet up with the cattle drive Ramrod Curly, played by the ever-scary Jack Palance at his maniacal best, I was on the floor with laughter, basically seeing a scene from my life played out on the screen.
I have to say, City Slickers definitely had moments of comedy that were actually funny, really laugh-out-loud funny. This is mostly due to the emotional element that went along with the comedy, making it a totally satisfying movie-going experience. The script by Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel is superb, with flowing dialogue that was real and relatable. It's definitely one of the best movies Billy Crystal has ever starred in.
And any movie that is written by two guys named Lowell Ganz and Babalu Mandel, how can it not be funny? Come on. This is a movie that captures lightning in a bottle, combining marvelous humor with an emotional and relatable story about three friends in the search to find out who they really are as people without ever becoming maudlin. Everything combines here in the form of comedy, drama, and Western, in a film that is a joy to watch because of the intelligent script and the smoothly flowing action that never lags.
Westerns near the turn of the century may not have been breathing the rarefied air of the 1950s, but they weren't on life support either. In the year 2000, Jackie Chan, Owen Wilson, and Lucy Liu starred in Shanghai Noon, the first in a pair of films, followed by Shanghai Nights and a rumored third flick that's never arisen, Shanghai Dawn. Shanghai Noon was one of those movies I was prepared to hate, despite the fact I love the subgenre of martial arts westerns, as exemplified in the original TV show Kung Fu and the Lone Star adult western paperbacks.
Chan plays Chan Wayne, a play, of course, on John Wayne. He's a Chinese imperial guard drawn into an attempt to retrieve the royal princess Pepe, who has fled to America in order to escape her arranged marriage. Wayne meets up with good-natured outlaw Roy O'Bannon, played by Owen Wilson. The two must avoid the men who are gunning for them while still rescuing the princess.
It sounds good on paper, and despite being entertained by several Jackie Chan movies in the 90s, but when I saw the theatrical trailer, I cringed. More slapstick, I thought. More adolescent humor. More of the same old high fantasy style medieval type trappings. Shanghai Noon has all of that, but I was pleasantly surprised. Remember how wrong I was about that collection of Western ephemera at the start of the show? Same sort of deal. Something about the spirit and energy everybody brought to the film really pulled it off. It never really feels like a Western to me, but it certainly got some laugh-out-loud scenes and some great action sequences. As the writers and directors play with all the Western tropes, it turned out a lot better than I had thought it would.
My reaction to our next offering might seem surprising, too. In 2011, a brilliant piece of storytelling in Western comedy and action was fronted by the unlikely character of an anthropomorphic chameleon named Rango. Johnny Depp voiced the computer-animated Rango, who finds himself caught up in a chameleon-out-of-water tale, when he becomes stranded in the Mojave Desert after his terrarium falls from his owner's car in an accident caused by an armadillo named Roadkill, voiced by Alfred Molina.
Rango is a visually stunning film and endlessly creative, well deserving of the Oscar it received for Best Animated Film. Not a movie for young kids, the story is simple and effective, filled with humor aimed at charming an adult audience with a freewheeling imagination and a sense of fun and adventure.
Not only is Rango a great animated film, it's a great Western. All the traditional tropes are included, but each is turned on its head with twists of imagination and color that truly kept me interested from beginning to end. The singing mariachi owls, who tunefully break down the fourth wall to open the film, are a hoot. I'm sorry. And provide the same services as the rooster in Disney's classic Robin Hood, helping move the story along while keeping you guessing. I love me some Buster Keaton and some City Slickers, but if I had to pick one movie to recommend to everyone who is listening, it would be Rango.
Let's go back to Jack Bickham, who wrote the Wildcat novels. He also showed his sense of all-ages fun when he wrote the story about a shady gambler and a clutch of orphans that became the Disney film The Apple Dumpling Gang.
For a while in the late 1960s and early 70s, Disney headed west for family-oriented comic adventure with movies like The Apple Dumpling Gang and The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again. But the era is perhaps best bookended by The Adventures of Bullwhip Griffin in 1968 and Hot Lead and Cold Feet from 1978.
The Adventures of Bullwhip Griffin is a 1967 effort directed by James Nielsen, who also directed Jimmy Stewart in 1957's Night Passage. Roddy McDowell, Suzanne Plachette, and Carl Malden star in a rousing musical spectacle based on a novel called The Great Horn Spoon by Sid Fleischman. The most interesting thing to me about the movie is the author of the book. Fleischman was that rare author who could leap from the world of children's books, where he won a Newbery Medal, to adult offerings, two of which really caught my attention. First, Fleischman adapted his own novel, Yellowleg, for the screen, released as The Deadly Companions, which was director Sam Peckinpah's first feature. Later, he worked on several projects with Kirk Douglas, including Scalawag, a Western remake of Treasure Island, two movies I've never seen, but are now on my must-see list.
Originally titled Welcome to Bloodshy, I'm thinking some Disney executive somewhere likely thought that title a little too bloody, and so the dubious title Hot Lead and Cold Feet replaced it. The movie starred Jim Dale in another one of those dual roles reminiscent of Cat Ballou, along with Karen Valentine, Don Knotts, Jack Elam, and Darren McGavern. The story of feuding brothers, one a minister, the other a drunken outlaw, in competition for the family inheritance is amusing. But it's Knotts as Sheriff Denver Kid and Elam as the outlaw called Rattlesnake that steal the picture in a delightful series of sick gun showdowns and comic vignettes. Watching it just to see these two masters of comedy at work is well worth it.
So you don't need to tune into a podcast about genre entertainment to know that race in America is an issue every bit as challenging today as it was in the Wild West. The problems might be largely the same, but the way we deal with them over the decades can be quite different.
In 1974, Jewish director Mel Brooks, no stranger to racism himself, attacked it with comedy when he released Blazing Saddles onto an open range of raw emotion. Coming off a decade of social unrest, Brooks told the story of Rock Ridge, a small town geographically positioned for a new railroad line, and the conniving attorney, Hedley Lamarr, who covets it. In the film, Lamarr, played by Harvey Korman, convinces the dim-witted governor to appoint a black sheriff to the town, reasoning that it will offend the lily-white townsfolk and create chaos.
Sheriff Bart, expertly portrayed by Cleavon Little, takes the office and ultimately wins over the town with the help of an alcoholic gunslinger, the Waco Kid, Gene Wilder, who says, "I've killed more men than Cecil B. DeMille."
It's a great line, but it's the kind of joke that audiences today might scratch their heads over. Again, though, it's a good example of Brooks's anachronistic screwball comedy.
To my mind, a great deal of the film is comic genius. The black railroad workers singing a cappella, "I Get a Kick Out of You," Slim Pickens' dopey henchman, Madeline Kahn's send-up of Marlena Dietrich, the irrepressible Alex Karras as Mongo, and the scene that affected me the most when I first saw the film, Karras punching out a horse.
Be warned, if you're not familiar with the film, there are plenty of racial slurs to offend just about anybody and everybody. Today, you have to look at Blazing Saddles in the context of the time it was made in order to understand it. In order to understand Brooks's point of view in using the offensive labels was to showcase how despicable, banal, and foolish they are, not to celebrate them. If you can get past these epithets, there are plenty of laughs to be found.
I'm not sure how Blazing Saddles comes across to the majority of young folks today, but for me, it holds up as well as when it was released. At the time, it was the fourth most profitable Western of all time. It received positive reviews from critics and audiences, was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, and was selected for preservation in 2006 by the National Film Registry as a work culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. Whether it survives the dust storms of our current cultural history is anybody's guess, but my money is on Brooks.
And despite the controversy Blazing Saddles caused when it was released, and the controversy it continues to generate today, Netflix removed the film from its streaming services until a recorded video warning of its content was added to the front of the film, it's still far superior to a more recent Western comedy, and I use the term loosely, A Million Ways to Die in the West. This is a film that might have looked good on the page of a screenplay, but not one laugh survived the transition from page to screen.
I have to agree with you. The 2004 film is a disaster of epic proportions. Written, directed, and starring Seth MacFarlane, A Million Ways to Die in the West struggled to find a single laugh in its 116-minute overlong running time that felt more like a 216-minute baton death march to anyone who didn't walk out of that theater.
The film follows a cowardly frontiersman who gains courage with the help of a female gunfighter and must use his newfound skills in a confrontation with her villainous outlaw husband. This is a good setup that fails miserably to fulfill its promise.
But despite the critical hate fest, A Million Ways to Die in the West did get the last laugh, grossing over $87 million worldwide against a budget of $40 million, and has gone on to garner another $15 million in home media sales after being released on DVD and Blu-ray. There's the clanging of the Chuck Wagon Triangle, partner, telling us to wrap up this episode with our shootouts and shoutouts.
Next Monday, Rich will be hosting a Six Gun Justice speed lesson on Owen Wister and how the West was written.
Thanks to our sponsors, Wolfpack Publishing, author Chris Enns, and the Western Writers of America.
And don't forget to tune in to our Six Gun Justice Conversations segment every Wednesday, when either Rich or I get to hang out around the virtual Six Gun Justice chuck wagon and chew the jerky with other Western wordslingers or friends who love the Western genre as much as we do.
And in 2 weeks, Paul and I will be back with episode 16 of the Six Gun Justice podcast. Until we meet again, be kind to each other, be kind to yourself, and be sure to pick up a copy of The Legend of the Black Rose,
available from Amazon in ebook format and paperback.
Adios for now.
We're out of here. Let's ride.
Join us in 2 weeks for another full-length episode of the Six Gun Justice Podcast, sponsored by author Chris Enns, the Western Writers of America, and Wolfpack Publishing, publishers of such best-selling Western series as The Legend of the Black Rose and Concho.